All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to What Is. So they tell a story about a Sunday school teacher who asks her students to draw a picture of God. These are young kids, and they each depict God in their own way. Maybe someone draws a sun, a rainbow, whatever it is. One of the kids draws a scale. And so the teacher asks, why do you think that this is God? Why do you think God looks like a scale? So the little girl says, I don't know, but every time my mother steps on a scale, she says, oh my God. That's a terrible joke. All right, so we are back. We are back with more mind-blowing, consciousness-expanding Kabbalah. And our topic today is indeed God. No, I'm not going to ask you to draw pictures of God, although there is paper in front of you. I'm not going to ask you to draw a picture of God. But today, I know. Well, maybe extra credit, you can't. But we're going to explore God. We've talked about the universe in Lesson 1. We talked about time in Lesson 2. And in each instance, God did come up as part of that other topic. So it came up in the context of, is the universe real? Is time real? But today we focus exclusively on God, more precisely on our understanding of God. And the core question we're going to ask, and it may sound like a weird question, but just hear me out here. The question is, today's question is God real? Is God real? And it's not, the question is not, let me tell you what it's not. This question is not, how do we know that God exists? Or can we prove the existence of God? That's a great topic for another time, another class, another opportunity. Today's question is God real? In the sense, is God something, someone, something that we can relate to? Is God just merely an abstract, abstraction, conception that we might believe in? In the Jewish and Kabbalistic understanding of God, how big is God? In other words, is God too big to have a relationship with? Is God too large to relate to? What would that look like anyway? What would a relationship with God look like anyway? I mean, we know what relationships look like with other human beings, but with God, what does it mean to be in a relationship with God? What does it mean to love God? The Torah says, you shall love the Lord your God. What does that mean to love God? So, and let's ask one final question. We have a lot of questions, and they're all around the topic. Does it make a difference if God is real or not in my life? Practically speaking, what difference does it make to me if God is real or if God is not real? Does it really change the way I live or what I do?
So, you have someone judging you and someone to whom you are accountable.
No, I understand. That part I understand. So if you feel like, okay, so someone's keeping score, right? There's a big scoreboard. So I have to make sure that I'm not going to be in the in the red. I can't be on a negative side of the slate. I have to be on the positive side. Okay, reward and punishment. But when we talk about being in a relationship with God, really it's more about the relationship part. Being in a relationship with God, not being in a relationship with God, what difference does it really make? So again, the core question is, all of these are kind of branches off the core question. The core question is God real in the sense that God is real to you and I? And something that we can relate to. There is so much to explore. This class, I will tell you straight up, this class is going to touch on some of the deepest insights, some of the deepest teachings of Judaism and Kabbalah. And it's going to change, I think, it's going to change the way you think about everything. Yes?
Okay, I can't even get past the first sentence.
Okay.
So, you're not talking about does God exist, but you're talking about is God real to me?
Is God real to us? Not even to me as an individual, but to us, to any of us.
So,
in other words, even if someone says, "I believe that there's a," I believe in God.
Okay, I believe God exists.
No, what does that mean for me?
No.
In other words, how real is that? I can know. One second, I can know, for example, that someone built this building. The fact that it exists means that there's an architect and a builder. Now what? Am I in a relationship with that person? Because I find myself in their building, does that by definition, does that automatically put me in a close relationship? And if I'm not in a relationship with the architect, can I not use the building? Can I not be a mensch in the building? In other words, it doesn't seem like there's any correlation between being in a relationship with the architect, so and being us. So the really the core of the question is, yes, this class is going to run with the assumption that God exists. But the question is not if God exists. The question is God real to you and I? Can God be real to you and I? Is God too big to be real, to be relatable to? These are all, I'll tell you this, I think the questions, I'm with you on the questions, they're being a little bit vague. The questions will become clearer as we answer them, if that makes sense, yeah.
Well, because your inference is, in your architect example, yes, every person sitting in this building has a relationship with the architect, but it's not a personal one. We don't know who the architect was. We don't know
well,
they designed the building.
Let me ask you a follow-up question. Do we have a relationship with the architect or with the architect's work?
Well, architect's work.
You see, so there's it's
yeah,
it's.
But how can you separate the architect from the architect's work?
Ah, that's okay. So that's a good question. The question is, how close is art and artist? Which we spoke a little. Okay, good. All of these are great questions. Let's
yeah,
jump in.
Yeah. Which reminds you that God is real to us.
Theoretically, I don't even notice it anymore. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah. Is a different word than real? Can you
sure.
Use
Well, here's the thing. I think that as we go through the discussion today, you'll understand why I'm using that word. And also, I think it works well with the course because each class is really the same. It's framed the same way. Is the universe real? Is time real? Is God real? Is evil real? Is consciousness real? Is choice real? Those are all the six classes, and it's all framed the same way. So for uniformity, we're stuck with it, but I think it also works conceptually, as we'll get to. So now, I want to jump in immediately with this point, after our opening and the questions, etc. The first thing I want to say is, I would argue, that everyone in this room has a slightly, if not larger than slightly, different conception of what God is. In other words, no two people, when you hear the word God, or when you think about God, I would venture to guess and say that no two people in this room are thinking or picturing or imagining or conceptualizing the same exact thing. Remember the dress?
Yes.
Was it white and gold? What were the colors? Or blue or black and blue? Remember this?
Yes.
Come on. You guys have to get online more often. Remember that?
That dress that the people.
Did you hear about the new one? Where there's an audio file.
People would look at the dress and they saw it in two different colors.
Yeah, literally the same picture of the dress.
It's the same dress.
The same.
People looked at it and saw it in gold and white. And some
remember this?
People saw it in
black and blue.
Either black or green and white. It was two different colors.
Yeah. Two different color schemes. And it was amazing that people, you guys didn't see this?
No.
This is a few years back.
Uh-oh.
In the early days of the internet. Like 2015. No, I'm kidding. I'm joking about it. Yeah, I know. It was only a few years ago. But here's the point. People, in general, have different concepts of the same thing.
Exactly.
When it's a thing. Okay, after the class, please remind me. I have an audio file on my phone that somebody sent me. And different people listen to it and hear different words. It's the wildest thing. I hear something clearly, and people that I know hear something completely different. And I want to get your take on it because it's also like the same thing with the dress. It is. Have you heard this?
Today
it went around today.
Yeah.
I don't want to influence anybody here in the room. You get a fresh slate after the class. But here's my point. We all have different concepts of things, right? The famous question: how do I know that the color that I see is the color that you see, right? Nussin, what color shirt are you wearing?
Green.
We all call that green. But how do you know that green looks the same to each person, even if we all call it the same, because we're all saying that is green? How would you describe a color?
That makes sense, because every camera shows a color differently.
Right. The core point is that we all have different perspectives on things, especially when it comes to something as, I don't know what the right word is, something as I'm not going to say vague, but something as esoteric, big, right? Distant as God. So when we talk about God, again, I would argue that everyone in this room, if you close your eyes and you think, you imagine God, whether you're picturing an image or whether you're picturing an unimage and a concept or whatever it is that you're picturing, I would venture to say that the totality of that imagination, of that experience, of that awareness that you have of God is different for every single person in this room. So let's illustrate this. How would you, by raise of hand, describe God? Let's take four or five or six different ideas. How would you describe God? I'm not picking on you, I'm just... A big cloud. Okay. Oh, just big, larger.
Yes. Undefined shape.
Undefined. God is in the cloud, folks. It's not just computing. Yes. Huh. What is that?
Chaos.
Chaos. Oh, chaos.
Chaos.
Okay.
But in chaos, there is pattern.
In chaos, there's pattern. Okay, good. I like that. Good. Bright light. What else? God. Yes. All powerful and ever and all around. What else?
Bessin Hicks, meaning the source, the original source.
The source. Good. All of these are true aspects of God. But do you see how everyone, and I know we just took a small sample, but everyone has a little bit of a different take, a little bit of a different perspective on who God is, what God is. We don't even know what to say. Is God a who? Is God a what? I mean, what's the proper etiquette? You know, is God a being that we say who, or is God a reality that we say what? I mean, who knows? So there are so many different perspectives. And therefore, it's, I think, helpful to have help in understanding God. And the good news is that Judaism provides a very solid framework for understanding God. We're going to, so here's the outline. Here's the outline for the class. We're going to explore, describe, and discuss three classic understandings of God brought in Jewish philosophical and mystical sources. And then we're going to bring a fourth that totally wipes the floor, if that's a good thing. It means, like, in a good way, right? It, like, totally, I don't know, like a strong enough expression. It's totally going to be a game changer. So three classic understandings of God, and then the fourth that will change everything. So let's begin with number one. The first and most basic, most fundamental understanding of God is God, and this wasn't, I don't think it was mentioned when I asked how you describe God, but God as creator. Who is God? Oh, yeah, you mentioned that. Yeah, God is source. Yeah. So who is God, or what is God? First basic Jewish definition is God is the creator. Where's the first time that we encounter that definition of God in the Torah? As God as creator. When's the first time we find God in that role, in that definition? The third word, right? Bereshit, bara Elokim, even the second word. Right? God, in the beginning, God created heaven and earth. So immediately in Torah, immediately in the Bible, the first introduction to God is, who is God? What is God? Well, this is what we know. God is the creator. He's the designer, the author, the maker, the architect of all of creation of the universe. It's the most obvious thing that we can say about God. Let's take a look at text number one. Text one, you can find it in your books. Oh, this is great, from the Midrash. Text one, Howard, please read this one, page 91 in your textbooks. There you go. Now, here you see, first of all, that 2,000 years ago, Jews were still answering questions with a question. So that's one thing we know that's consistent. It's all the way through. You ask me a question, I'll ask you a question. I'll question your question, and with that, hopefully, you'll be answered. So he says, Rabbi Akiva, how do you know the world? How do you know God created the world? And he answers, don't you see the world is created by God? Done. End of dialogue. I mean, that's basically the punchline, right? Question with a question. But he points out that if you look at the cloak, you look at the robe, and you look at the, I use the building example, there's an architect, there's a builder, there's a weaver, right? You know that if something exists, it has a source. Now, the point of this, by the way, is not to prove the existence of God. It's not to say, that's how we know God exists, because as I said at the opening, we're not trying to prove that God exists. We're working with the assumption that God does exist, but we want to know who God is. Who is God? What is God? What is this entity, this reality that we call God? And can we be in a relationship with God? That's the objective, not to prove the fact of God. So this text, although it seems to be proving the fact of God, the existence of God, what I want to extract from this is a very simple point, and that is, what is God's most basic definition? The basic way that we understand God, the basic understanding of God, is God as creator. Just like a cloak, a garment, has a sewer or a weaver, so too the universe has a creator and a master. And so, who is God? What is God? Creator of heaven and earth. We got it. Very simple. Take a look at Nachmanides, Ramban. Charna, please read text number 2. Page 92. So here we have Nachmanides explaining that the very first mitzvah, the very first commandment that we have, is to acknowledge God. And he says, what does that mean? Accept the sovereignty of heaven. What does that mean? To believe that there's a God who creates. So what is belief in God? Nachmanides, Ramban, the great, he was also a mystic, the great biblical sage and mystic, says that belief in God, belief in God, and acknowledging God means that you acknowledge God as the creator, the one who is in control, who brings everything into existence. And again, he mentions the idea of something from nothing. He brings something from nothing. Susan, right? We have an opening spot, right? And then he says, this is the meaning of God's introduction at Mount Sinai, where he says, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I am the Lord your God, or I am God your God. What that means is, I am the one who is in control and who brought everything into being. Okay, text number 3, final text for this section, comes from the Zohar. Yaakov.
You shall know that I am God your God. This commandment is primary to all commandments, to know that there is a supernal ruler who is the master of the world, who created all worlds, the heavens and the earth and everything in them.
So basic, again, we see a similarity between all three texts. They're all saying more or less the same idea, that who is God? What is God? What does it mean to believe in God? It means to know that God is the master of the world and created all worlds. So here we go. The first definition, first basic, fundamental definition of God is God as creator. God is the origin and source, right? That was mentioned before, Dr. Maxey. Origin and source. And there's also active involvement, as was mentioned in text 2 and 3. God not only created, but is also the master of the world, and he can create. He brings somethingness into being from nothingness in any manner, shape, or form that he so chooses. That means that there is some sort of active involvement as well as to how things shape out or how things take shape. So, what we see from all of this is that the first answer to the question, who is God, is God created all of this. Here is the limitation of this perspective. See, Judaism and Kabbalah, so they don't stop here. God is much more than the creator. And I'll share with you some of the arguments or some of the proofs that we might ascribe to this. But let's first read this idea captured by Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Liadi, the Alter Rebbe, the founder of the Chabad Hasidic movement, who writes in his book called Torah Ar the following. Text number 4, page 93. Anastasia.
The fact that all the worlds are brought into existence by God and receive their vitality and the sustenance from Him, this is not the essence of what God is. For as we say, you are who you are before the world was created, and you are who you are after the world was created. exactly the same. Also, if God would not create the world, all would be the same regarding him.
Thank you. Somebody tell me, what is the punchline of the Alter Rebbe statement? What is he saying here? What is God not, and what is God? What's he saying?
He's not time and space.
Okay.
He existed before and after the world.
Okay, but what if we're defined? Is it? Let me ask you a question. Is according to the Alter Rebbe, according to text 4, can you accurately describe God as the Creator? Yes or no? Yes. Is the totality of God the Creator?
No.
No. Why not?
It's a small part.
In other words, let me use my own terminology here, and I think it'll be clear. Creation is something God does, but it's not who God is. Creation is something God does, so to call God the creator of heaven and earth, of the universe, is accurate. It's accurate. It's true. But it's not the totality of who God is. And I'll give you a simple example. Albert Einstein is walking down the street. The brilliant Einstein. And he notices a young girl who's 4 years old. And her shoelaces are untied. And he says to her, "Can I help you with your shoelaces?" And she says, "Yes." And he bends down. He's a nice fellow. He bends down and he ties her shoelaces. And she says, "Thank you." And he walks away. To her, who is he?
The shoelace
tier. He's the shoelace. That's what he is. That's his role, his function. In her world, in her reality, that's how he appears in her reality. To her, his role, his job, his existence, his popping in and popping out is in one context. Tying her shoes. Is that who Albert Einstein is? A shoe tire? Shoelace tire? Come on.
At that moment, yes.
At that moment, that's what he does.
Right.
But there's a difference between what one does and who one is. Right? All the time we do things that don't. Now, we can also do things that purely represent us and are us, etc. That's true. But often, we're doing things that aren't us. It's like the famous story of Bertrand Russell, who was an ethicist and a mathematician, a professor. And so again, he taught ethics, and one time he was caught doing something unethical, and one of his colleagues called him out on it. And said, "Hayitachen," which in Yiddish or in Hebrew means, how could you? Like, this too, right? You teach ethics and you're involved in such unethical behavior. And he said, his response was, "Listen, I also teach trigonometry and I'm not a triangle." So like, I don't have to be what you teach, right? But that shows the disconnect between activities that we're involved in and who we are. So Albert Einstein is tying this young girl's shoes, right? Helping her tie her laces, her shoelaces. That does not make him, that does not define him in totality as a shoelace tier. There's much more to Albert Einstein than tying shoelaces. The Alter Rebbe in text 4 says the same thing about God on a much greater level, infinitely greater level. God, yes, God created heaven and earth. That's true. God himself wrote it in the Torah. All of that is true. But is that the essence of God? Is that the totality of God? Is that the be-all and end-all of God? Is that all that there is? The Alter Rebbe says no. And if you look at the language, look at this. The fact that God created everything is not the essence of what God is. It's what God did, and it's what God does, according to last week's class of continual creation. But it's not who God is. God is not a creator. God created, but is God a creator? God is no more a creator than Einstein is a shoelace tire. And if you define Einstein as a shoelace tire, I will tell you that you're missing out on a lot about Albert Einstein. Because you're missing out on a lot of great things that he accomplished and the great things that he lived for. Not just tying shoelaces. So the Alter Rebbe is making the same argument. The essence of God is not creation. Can you say that God is the creator? Of course he's the creator. But is God the creator? Is the essence of God creation? So Kabbalah, mysticism says, not exactly. And we say this in the prayers. This is the second half of the text. Atahu koydim shenivra olam vatu la'achar shenivra. You are the same before and after creation. In other words, creation doesn't make you who you are. You see, when something makes you who you are, you're different before and after. One could say that being a parent creates a fundamental change. It's not just something you did, but it's something who you are now. Right? One could make that argument. Right? We can have a debate whether that's true or not, but one could make that argument and say that that's not something that one just does. It's part of what one is. But if you say that God is the same before and after creation, what that implies is that creation is something God did. But you know what? It's not like it changed God in any fundamental way. God is still the same before. God is still the same after. It's something God did. It's something that we're grateful for. Right? The little girl's shoelaces are tied. It helped her. In her world, it's a big deal. In our world, this is everything. Right? This is all we have. And God created this, and that's fabulous. But is that God? Who is God? What is God? Creator. That's it. I use the example sometimes in our Sunday morning Kabbalah classes. We have a Kabbalah class every Sunday morning. I sometimes use the example, actually a parenting example, but I use it the other way. You know, a child thinks that the totality of the parent, and I know I'm going to go exact opposite of what I just said, and that's fine. In Kabbalah, you have contradictions all the time. I remember we used to ask our teachers in yeshiva, like, in one mystical text, it says this. In another one, it says this. The answer was always the same. Sevenzach v'meret, which means it depends what the context is, right? It's right? In one place it'll say this, in another place it'll say something else, but you have to understand the context. So in this context, I've used the example, in different contexts, I've used the example the other way. A child might look at a parent and say, my parent only exists to parent me. Like, the only identity of the parent only exists, the only life and essence of the parent in the child's eye is relative to them. Right? A child doesn't typically say, at least at a younger age, doesn't see a parent as a human being outside of the role of parent. A parent to a child is a parent. It's mom or dad or tati and mommy or ima or abba. That's all a parent is. At a certain age, a child realizes that, there's also, the parent also has a life outside of parenting, or other interests that don't only revolve around the children, although it's a big part of it, but it's not the totality. So again, the point here is that although creation and the idea of God creating heaven and earth and the universe and all that we have is a big deal, certainly for us, it's not the essence. It's not the essence of God. Yes.
Just because the girl sees this guy that comes in and he ties her shoes.
Yes.
And however, as a very aware, small person, she can gain a lot of information about this person, how he ties the shoes. You know, how that the fact that he did tie the shoes, that does he do it in a brusque way just to get rid of her, or does he do
right.
it in a caring way? So the same thing with the world. It seems like we're also on this scavenger hunt of information.
We can pick up clues about God.
We can pick clues about
from what he does.
From what he does.
I like that. Yes, but that still runs with the premise that creation is what God did, and there are clues to be gleaned, right? But it's not who God is, and maybe it reflects in some way who God is, but it's not the essence and totality of what God is. So, for defining God, the first definition is Creator. That's God is the creator. And then we get a little bit deeper. It's like, well, God's just the creator? That's all God is? God doesn't have like another life beyond creation? God certainly does. God is way beyond this. So then now the question is, so how do we define God? So what we're going to do is turn to Maimonides. And Maimonides is going to help us articulate if you cannot define God by the creation that he did. If that's insufficient, if that's not sufficient to define God, because it's just what he did, it's not who he is. So then how do we define God? So now we're stuck. So we said that God is the creator, but that's not accurate. So now so then what is God? Who is God? So let's put some words to this. Adir, you have to read in text 5?
The first foundation is belief in the existence of the Creator, capitalized, plus be He. Namely, that there is a being who is perfect in every manner of existence. Only He possesses true unity and mastery. He is utterly self-sufficient and does not require the existence of anything other than, whereas all other existences require Him in order to exist.
Okay, so text 5, Maimonides, uses language that we're already familiar with based on the previous two sessions that we've had in this course. And what Maimonides is saying, basically, is that God, well, he does call God the Creator, but he doesn't define God's totality as Creator. So notice how he develops this. So first foundation in belief, or is belief, that there is the existence of the Creator. So he calls God the Creator, but then he begins to move God beyond that. And he calls God, he refers to God existing outside and independent of all other existences. So God's being is perfect in every manner of existence. Only He possesses true unity and mastery. Utterly self-sufficient. Does not require the existence of any other thing. Whereas all other existences require Him in order to exist. So he's creating this divide, fundamental divide between God's manner of existence and God's reality and everything else. God is not dependent on any other factor to exist, whereas everything else is dependent on something else to exist. In other words, using terminology that will come up in text 6, everything else is what we'll call contingent existence. It exists, but it's contingent on something else making it exist or defining its existence. I'll explain this soon. Only God is what we might call absolute existence. Mechuyev hametziut. Absolute existence. Existence that just is absolutely. This is a radically different definition of God than Creator. You see, our first definition of God is, who is God? What is God? The Creator of heaven and earth. We've moved past that. Now, who and what is God? God is absolute existence. The only existence that just is, that wasn't made, that's not dependent on anything, that doesn't require something else to shape or identify or define it. You see, everything else is defined by everything around it. Think about it. Everything is literally defined by everything around it. The contours of any existing physical substance, any piece of measurable matter, its contours and definition is defined by its relation to everything else. In other words, its literal shape is defined by how far it goes and where it doesn't go. Where it ends means there's other and then there's it. In other words, everything is defined by how it exists relative to something else. God is absolute existence, not defined by anything else, not contingent upon anything else. Does it make sense? All right, let's keep on going. Text number 6. Susan.
From the first principle, which is the existence of God, extend 4 roots, which include all the truths that are derived from the fact that God's existence is an absolute existence. These are the divine unity, as we explained in the text, that God is neither a body nor a bodily force, but God is timeless and that God has no deficiency.
Thank you. So the Ikarim, Rabbi Yosef Albo, great Jewish philosopher, so he says the following, picking up from where Maimonides left off, or playing off of this idea, Rabbi Yosef Albo says the following. He says God is absolute existence, which I just explained means that God's existence is not contingent upon anything else, nor is it shaped by the contours of anything else. There's no definition for God. In other words, God is not defined by anything else, nor dependent upon anything else. So that's number 1. from that core point, he says, four roots or branches, whatever, emanate from that point. Number one, divine unity, which means not only is there one God, but there's only oneness. God is not a composite of different things. God is completely one. All right, I got it. The second point is, God does not possess a body or bodily force. In other words, God doesn't have physical characteristics. The third is that God is beyond time, which we spoke about last week, and God has no deficiencies. All of those four points stem from the fact that God is absolute existence as opposed to contingent existence. Yeah.
There's a physical form right there.
No, so the burning bush is God manifesting on some level some format of sound to be audible to Moses. Now, how did that work? When the prophets heard God speaking, did they hear it in like with audio waves like we hear sound? Did they sense it? Did it go straight to the brain? You know, they have now headphones that work with bone conductivity. Are you familiar with that? It actually, you put it on the bone and it just vibrates straight into wherever it needs to, whatever part of the ear.
So you hear it.
So you hear it from the inside. So you can hear it underwater. These are underwaters. Yeah.
I have had swim P3 players, like you put them under your swim cap, and you can play like music and podcasts while you're swimming laps.
Right.
It's through bone.
Yeah, it's conducive to the bone. No, so the point is that I don't know how God pulled it off. How God injected that information. The point is, God does not have bodily form or bodily force. And Maimonides says, any time you encounter an anthropomorphic term, which means a term in the Bible and Scripture that appears to ascribe human physical qualities to God, Maimonides says, you should know, don't read it literally. God took the Jewish people out with an outstretched arm. Really? No. That's not what that means. It means euphemistically that God used a power like someone's hand that's powerful. So God used a force to extract the Jewish people. Does not mean that God sees from the beginning of the year to the end of the year. God does not need eyes to see. And the sight is not the way we understand sight. The point of all this is really not the anthropomorphism. That's again another class. The point of this is the following. Our second definition of God is that God is absolute existence. God is not just the creator, that's something he did. But if you have to define God himself, who and what is God? God is. God is. God is isness. Isiosity. God just is. Everything else was made and God is. Again, this is a theme that we had in the first two classes. Everything else was made, has a beginning point, and from there it starts. God always exists. And God doesn't only not have an origin. Again, I've been emphasizing this. I hope it's coming across clearly. God does not have anything outside of God that defines who and what God is. Again, everything in existence other than God is defined by what it's not. A building like this is defined as much as the shape that it has by what exists outside, as it is by what's outside of the shape. In other words, everything that has a shape, everything that has a form, that form means that it extends so far and doesn't extend past it. There's a contrast between it and that which exists beyond it. Whereas God is defined absolutely on God's own terms. God is not defined by relative terms. Everything else, that's maybe a good way of phrasing it. Everything else in existence is defined in relative terms. What it is and what it's not. It's not only tangible, it's what it is and what it's not. Every definition of a word is what it is, and it's telling you also what it's not. The word cat means an animal that's a feline. And it doesn't mean a dog, a bird, a fish, etc. Every definition is not only telling you what it is, but it's telling you what it's not. And it's more not than what it is. Right? There's more of what it's not than what it is. It's only one thing, and it's not many, many, many things. So when it comes to everything in existence, everything is measured by what it's not. That helps define what it is. Whereas God is not defined by anything outside of God that allows us to understand what God is or who God is. Not even, forget us. Let me scratch that from the record. It's not about us knowing who God is. It's about who God is himself. God is absolute existence, existence that has no outside origin and has no outside parameters or realities defining what it is. Can I help you? Yeah.
See how powerful your class is. It's bringing people into memory.
Okay. Let's keep on going. So here we have, So here we have the second definition of God. Our first definition is God as creator. Second definition is God as absolute existence. And again, according to Kabbalah, according to Jewish philosophy and Kabbalah, this is a much deeper definition. This is a much deeper definition of what God is. One final text to round out this point. This is a beautiful text, and it's also a little bit of an esoteric text from the Midrash. Alana?
Rav Huna said in the name of Rabbi Ami, why do we call God by the title Makom, place? Because God is the place of the world, whereas the world is not the place of God.
So look at this. The Midrash is discussing why is it that one of God's names is Makom. Makom means place or space. One of God's names is space, place, physical space. Why? So the answer is because God is the space of the world, whereas the world is not the space of God. Listen to that concept. In other words, the entire space of the world only exists by virtue of God existing. If God didn't exist, nothing else could exist because everything else is contingent existence. Remember, only God is absolute existence. Everything else is contingent, which means that it's dependent on God existing. So God is the place of the world. Without God, there's no world. There can't be space without God. But the world is not the place of God. God is not dependent on the world. God is not dependent on creation, and that harkens back to the first point. So although God is a creator, God does not need creation. Something God did, it's not something that he requires. Are you with me on this? Again, God created, but he doesn't need creation to exist. Because God's existence, God's reality is absolute, irrespective of any other factor, of any other reality, of any other dimension. Make sense? Let's put up on the board a few points over here to recap. The lighting kind of fades it out, but hey, it's a Kabbalistic concept, a topic, so light is good. So creator, again, is something God does, but not what God is. Absolute existence, we said, requires nothing outside of itself in order to be, and is not conditional upon, nor defined by, and that's the second point, God is not defined by, as absolute existence, anything outside of itself. Okay, conditional existence, on the other hand, is conditional upon factors outside of itself. Conditional upon space, conditional upon time, etc. Okay. Now, make sense so far? We have two definitions? Fantastic. Any questions thus far?
So, it's kind of like you have the writer and they write, but that's not all they are.
Right, exactly, right. You wrote a book, but there's also who you are outside of that. And again, that's the first definition, which we already said is a little too basic. The deeper explanation is God is absolute existence. God just is. God was not made. Everything else is made. God just is. But we can go even deeper. You see, calling God the ultimate isness, right? God is. Everything else was made. God just is. Calling God that, defining God as existence, is also limiting God. Because existence, isness, is not something that always was, or, more precisely, is not something that needs to be. Let me explain. In our reality, we know existence. That's a thing that we have, or that we at least feel that we have. That was lesson one. Do we really exist? But, right? That's at least what we think we have, what we feel that we have. Isness, existence. And so we go on a journey with that, and we say, well, we're real, we exist. And then we say, okay, we exist. How do we get here? So God exists. So God's the creator. But God's not only the creator, because that sounds too small of a role. So God is beyond just the creator. God is the ultimate of existence. How, in a sense, myopic, though, is that approach? We're taking a construct that is at the heart of our reality, i.e. existence, and applying that to God and saying that is the essence of God's reality, is existence, absolute existence. Are you with me on this? It's like a child saying that you know who God is, God has the most toys. If a child imagines that having a lot of toys is good, more toys than less are good, so if you have the ultimate being probably has the most toys. All the toys. All the toys. Isn't that what we're saying by calling God absolute existence? We start off from a premise of existence. What else is there? There's existence. So we say we exist. I'm going to do this. I know I just did this. I'm going to do it one more time. We exist. That's our starting point. We exist. Right? Pinch ourselves. Not a dream. I exist. Done. Where do I come from? Creator. God. Oh, I've discovered God. But is God just a creator? God doesn't have a side job? God, maybe this is a side job. Okay, so God is not just a creator. God is bigger than all of this. So it's I exist only because he made me. But God exists outside of anything else. God is ultimate existence, absolute existence.
Maybe God is like
God has the most toys. That's what I'm saying. Essentially what we're saying is God has the most toys. Because toys are important to me. Toys are at the center of my universe. Right? So God has the ultimate of that. So existence is the center of our reality. So we say God is the ultimate of existence. God is absolute existence. Do you understand that? That's still myopic. How do we know that God is absolute existence? Maybe existence itself, the concept of existence, is not in at all in God's essential. To God's essence doesn't even exist. Who says existence needs to be? You with me on this? Who says existence is a thing that's important? Is a thing that God is essentially? Who says? Because we find existence important, so God is the ultimate of that which we find important? Right? How do we know that God is truly and absolutely the absolute existence? Are you with me on this question? Does it make sense? The best example that I'm finding, at least for myself, is the child and the toy God example. The child God toy construct. Child says God has God is the ultimate. God has the most toys. Infinite toys. That's still, right? It's still boxing in. That's like it's funny sometimes when students size up their teachers and they say, I know why my teacher did this. It's because. And the child is thinking as a student and not looking at it from the teacher. Like, even as a student tries to project onto the teacher, it's still through the lens of the student. And so this argument on the definition of God as being absolute existence, the argument against that is we're still defining God through our lens. And we're saying, no, 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 but we're not, right? We're theoretically not. Because we're contingent existence. And we're doing God a favor by saying God is not contingent on anything else. He always was and he always will be. He's forever. How do you know? How do you know that existence is a thing or was a thing or is an important thing? Because to you it's important. Maybe God made all that. And maybe beyond that, there's no existence. Or maybe there's something else that's a different word that we don't even imagine. But how do we know that it means absolute and ultimate existence? Does this question make sense?
I can answer.
It's a question that is. It's a deep question, and it's a question that challenges the very way our minds work, because the question touches on undoing everything we know about reality. That's really what it is. You can't give God the most candies and say, God, you're the best. That's it. You got the most candies and the most toys. See, I'm sizing you up accurately. God has the best existence. We have inferior existence. Ours is contingent. We're defined by other things outside of ourselves. We don't exist for ourselves. You, God, you have the ultimate of existence. Slow clap for that one. You're doing God a favor by giving him the ultimate existence. He doesn't need your favors. Who says God is existence to begin with? Okay, I know I've asked the question about 17 times, but my hope is that it's making sense. I want to share with you the following. Text number 8. Text number 8, you will find at the end of text 8, it will be dazzlingly, is that right? Yeah. Beautiful. And you will see, you will discover a truth to text 8 that you will not see when you first read it, when we first read it together. And I will share with you, this insight comes from the Lubavitcher Rebbe, who shared this in 1985. It's a relatively new insight, mystical insight. It's giving me the goosebumps. This will hopefully, if I'm able to share the message properly, this will lift. This will blow your mind. Text number 8. So far, it's going to just be Maimonides. And. And I will tell you, thank you, and I will tell you that if you do a quick reading of this, even if you read it many times, you'll probably come away with thinking that, yeah, this is what we're saying. This is the same thing that we've been saying. Right? Let's break it down. Okay, it's the foundation of all foundations. Okay, this is really important. That's the preamble. So what's important to know that there's, number one, a primary existence who brought all existences into being. So God is the creator. But not only creator, but primary existence, which we might say is absolute existence. All the beings came into existence only from the truth of his existence. And number two, should it arise in the mind that he is not in existence, nothing else could exist. In other words, it's the same thing. Everything else is contingent on his existence, but he's not contingent on anything else. It seems like the same thing that we're talking about. It's the same point, right? One second. It seems like the same point that we're talking about. Which is that everything, there's a vast gulf of distinction between everything else that so-called exists and God, who is the only true existence. Everything else exists only from God. God does not exist from anything else. God just exists, and from that true existence, everything else comes to exist. And it seems like he's saying it twice. Again, number one says, all beings came only from his existence. And what's number two saying? If he didn't exist, they couldn't exist. You're saying it one way and then backwards and forwards. You're saying it one way and then the flip side. Two sides of a coin. Everything comes from God. If God didn't exist, nothing else would come. Do you really need a separate halacha and Rambam? A separate law, Aleph and Bet? You need a separate paragraph to just give you the flip side, the negative of the positive. The positive is that everything only comes, only, it says only is an exclusive term. All the beings have only come from the truth of his existence. You need a number two to tell you. And if he didn't exist, nothing else could be. Obviously, if they only come from God, if God didn't exist, then nothing else could be. You need to spell it out. So the Rebbe says, missing the whole point. Missing the whole point. Number two is not a repetition of number one. It's telling us something completely differently. V'im ya'al al hadas. Not if you imagine, if you think. Im ya'al al hadas. If you want to lift your mind to a higher awareness, Rambam is telling you, it's not a simple explanation of Rambam, of Maimonides. This is not the simple explanation. This is Im Yalal Adas. If you really want to think big, if you want to elevate your mind and really think about the truth of God's existence, you'll realize Shehu Einei Matzli. You realize that God does not exist. Now, here, the rabbi said that God doesn't exist. Isolate the tape, boys. This is getting V'im Yalal Adas. If you really want to elevate your consciousness, you'll realize Shehu Einei Matzli, that God transcends the whole construct of existence. God is not defined by existence, not even the term absolute existence, because that means the best of existence. It's like a rerun. The best of the 80s, 90s, and today. The best of Seinfeld. This is the best of existence. No. God is not limited to the best of existence. V'im Yalal Adas, if you really want to think big, you'll realize Shehu Einei Matzli, that God is beyond existence. And if God exists in a way of non-existence, which is non-existent existence or just non-existence, then Ein Davar Acher Yochel Himatzei, then nothing exists. In other words, on a level where nothing exists. Let me show you something here. No? Hold on. Does it make sense in a nonsensical way?
Yes.
There you go. That's what we're looking for. It makes sense in a way of not knowing it, but you kind of sense it, right?
As long as you don't explain it, it makes sense.
That's exact. It makes sense. You're right. So let's do some visuals. Take a look. This is it. This is Maimonides 1:2. Let me explain to you the import of this. Maimonides, physician, astronomer, rabbi, scholar, author, Jewish legal authority, all that good stuff. He wrote Yad HaChazaka, 14-volume compendium of Jewish law. He wrote in his introduction that all you need to do is study the Torah, the five books of Moses, and my book. He called it Mishnah. This is what he wrote. He says you don't have to study the Talmud, the Mishnah, all that stuff. It just kind of goes like this in circles and back and forth. Study the Torah, study me, and you'll get everything. You'll get the whole Torah. He articulated every single law, every single halacha. The Code of Jewish Law, subsequent volumes of Codes of Jewish Law, only have those laws that are pertinent to outside of Israel, or maybe even Israel, but non-temple times, not sacrificial law, not ritual law, etc., ritual purity laws. Maimonides has every single mitzvah explicated, explained, detail, detail, detail. 14 volumes, one of the most magnificent works in all of Jewish history. And you wonder how one person could have put this together without Wikipedia, without Torahpedia, without a computer, without copy and paste, without anything. You know, and a physician all day, he had to be in the court of the whoever was in charge over there, whatever they call the person in charge.
When did he have the time?
He says he used to work all day. Mm-hmm. He would come home at night. And by the time he came home, he wrote this letter to somebody. There was a line around the block from the Jewish community, people waiting for his physician stuff. He went inside. He apologized for grabbing a quick bite. He would grab a quick bite, come back out, meet people. He said he was so tired, he would lie down and he would dispense advice while like reclining, resting. And then he would study in the evening and late night and then wake up and do it again. This was free medical advice. You know the story about the doctor who goes over, the doctor in synagogue, and every Shabbat, every Saturday, so people ask the doctor for advice. This is hurting me. What do I do? This, that, the other. And he's like, he wants to help, but every single week, lines of people, casually, like, oh, yeah, what do you think about that? Trying to get a full exam in, like by the challenge. Like, what's. So finally, he goes over to a lawyer and he says, look, does this happen to you? People ask you for legal advice? And this thing, like, is this a thing or is this just. He's like, no, people ask me. So he says, what do you do? They ask for free legal advice. What do you do? He says, I give them the advice, but then Monday morning, I send them a bill. By Tuesday, they have a bill. He says, that's great advice. By Tuesday morning, the doctor had a bill. I feel like I should just walk off after that joke. That's like a walk-off joke. That's like a mic drop. Okay, you guys ready? Okay, Maimonides. Oh, let's go back to this. So Mishnah Torah, 14 volumes. Organized, unbelievable. Organized like nothing. Like you couldn't imagine. This is Maimonides' first volume, opening book, opening chapter, opening everything. 1:2. 1:1 we had. Everything comes from the truth of God's existence. Number 2 is, if you think that God doesn't exist, nothing else could exist, which is a repetition of number one, unless you learn it like this. Should it arise in the mind? Take a look. Should it arise in the mind? A higher level of understanding this idea is that he is not in existence because he created existence, and that means that existence doesn't have to be. Existence is a choice, not a necessity. That the phrase absolute existence is, in this understanding, a misnomer. Absolute existence is the one with the most toys, through the lens of the child's eyes. Should it arise in the mind? When you want to have a higher level understanding of God, this is number two already. This is my mind, 1, 2. It means that he is not in existence because he created existence. God's beyond what he created. And on that level, nothing can possibly exist. On the level of God's true, I'm going to get stuck in language, I would say reality, but that's kind of like existence, and we're saying, no, God doesn't exist in the way of existence, that we know existence. Point is, in the truth of God, we cannot even use the phrase that God exists absolutely. You cannot justifiably or accurately or truthfully use that phrase. Which gives us an understanding of God on a much greater level. Level one, who is God? What is God? God is the creator of heaven and earth. That's not good enough. So level two, God is absolute existence. Existence, yeah, everything else exists, but it doesn't really exist. God really exists. And level three, God is beyond existence. We can't even ascribe any terminology to this third level. Because the moment you pin it down is the moment that we've lowered it down. You can't define it even as absolute existence. The best we can say is that level three definition is that God is beyond existence. So God is the creator. On a higher level, God is absolute existence. And an even higher level, God is beyond existence altogether. Right.
The smallest,
yes. You can conceive. Yeah. You can imagine it that way. Yeah. The beyond existence. Yeah. I mean, the only challenge with that is that you're still drawing a circle, which gives some sort of inkage on that thing, which is. But it's a depiction for us. But yeah, I like that notion because one doesn't necessarily negate the other. Right. God being beyond existence does not negate the fact that God exists absolutely, nor does it negate that God is the creator of heaven and earth. It doesn't. But what we're doing is we're expanding our consciousness and our understanding of God. And the highest level, so far, I told you already, we'll have three definitions, and then the fourth that changes everything. You thought this was the big finish. Seriously, come on. Come on, folks. This was three. We got four. One more. One that changes everything. But thus far, we have three understandings of God, each one climbing higher and higher. God creates. God is absolute existence. No beginning. God is beyond existence altogether. But what is God? I don't know, beyond existence. God is so big. You know what the problem is?
No, it's not big.
You know what the problem with this definition? You know what the problem with this definition? The problem with this definition is, what we've done is we've pushed God so far that I go back to my first question. Is God real to us? Not to me necessarily, but to any of us. To this whole thing. The bigger you make God, the further away you push God. God is not just a creator. He's absolute existence. He's beyond existence. Right? I like the circles. I'm kind of using that, right? God is, all the way out beyond anything that we can know or imagine. Not even the framework of existence exists for God. So now what? What do I do with that? So what do I know about God? Nothing. What do I know about God? All I know now is that I don't know. That's, on the highest level, what do I know? I don't know God. I can't know God. That's all I know. But I don't know God. I don't know God. And what kind of relationship do I have with a being that is beyond existence? beyond the very framework that I know, beyond even the best I was going to do for God is make him absolute existence. That was the highest promotion I was going to give him. And then we had this idea that he's beyond that. Now what? Now I'm done. I don't even have, I can't even give him a title. The only title is a non-title title. He's beyond titles. So that's not even, that's not a title. Come on, that's not a title. Beyond title. It's not a title. It's an anti-title. What kind of title is that? So I don't know God, and I don't have a relationship with God. So what's the problem? Here's the problem. The Torah says, know God. The Torah says, love God. And now I'm stuck. Because the more I learn, the more philosophy and Jewish philosophy and Kabbalah that I've learned, the more I realize that I cannot know God and that I cannot be in a relationship with God. Because how can you be in a relationship with that which is totally beyond existence altogether? How can you relate to that which doesn't exist?
By non-existing yourself?
One second. So understand what the problem with this is. The problem is, I have verses in the Torah that tell me to know God, and verses in the Torah that tell me to love God. How can I know? How can I love that which I've understood now to be completely beyond anything, not only completely beyond understanding, but beyond existence itself? The more I've pushed God up, the less I can relate to God. And so now here's the problem. The God that I know is not God. Einstein is not a shoelace tire. Oh, I know Einstein. He ties shoelaces. Then you don't know Einstein. God is, I know God is creator because I look at all this stuff, right? But you don't know God. That's not knowing God. We just did this for an hour and 10 minutes. This is not God. That's why we pushed God up, not because we were feeling generous, but because each point before that was not God. So who do you know? The Torah says, Shema Yisrael, hear O Israel. Shema also means da, know that God is one. Da et Elokei Avicha, know God your Father, know God. What does it mean to know God? Me to know God. What do you know? That he created? Did he tie shoelaces? That's not knowing him. And who is he on the highest level? Beyond existence? So then you don't know God. In other words, it's an impossible... Yeah. If you... The God that you know is not God. And the unknown God, you can't know. So now what? Make sense? Yes? You see where we're stuck? Here's where Kabbalah kicks in. There's one text that changes everything. Text 15. Wow, we just cut out a lot of the class here. Text 15. Don't worry, like I always say, you're in good hands. I DJ these classes. Okay, this is Rabbi Meir Ibn Gabay, Avodat HaKodesh. This changes everything. Dan, please read page 104, text 15. Before we understand, before we look at the implications of this, which are absolutely change everything. Before we understand the implications of this, let's understand what he's saying. K'shem she'yesh l'koach b'bilti ba'gvul, kach yesh l'koach b'gvul. Just like God has the power of unlimitedness, not being limited, infinity. Bilti Bagvul means not one that is limited. Right? Just as God has the ability or has the power of being unlimited, beyond limits, that's a better word, beyond limits, so too God has the power of limitation as well. Because if you say that he doesn't, then you're limiting God. So I'll give you an example. Before the example, so what he's saying is that God possesses both aspects. God is both beyond limitation and God is within limitation. Because if you say he's just beyond limitation, then you're limiting God to the realm beyond limitation. And you're not allowing God to access the realm of limitation. One second, hold on. 1 second. Now, you have to stop for a moment and think about what we're reading right now. So that God is infinite and beyond limitation, that's something that I think most of us will agree with. Right? That makes sense. God is not bound by the parameters of time and space, by the parameters of the universe, and as we said before, not even is God bound by the parameters of existence itself. God is beyond. That makes sense. But he says that God also possesses the power of being finite, of finitude. That sounds blasphemous. God is finite? It sounds like we're regressing our understanding of God. So let's take a moment to really understand what he's saying. If you make God so big and so grand and so beyond that God is too big to fit into this world, so you've locked God out of this space, God is too big to be here, so what you're doing, paradoxically, is limiting God to not being in this space. If God is only infinite and not finite, then you're limiting God to the space of the infinite, not the finite. Give you an example. You have a teacher, a kindergarten teacher. And then you have, in the other corner, you have a postgraduate astrophysics, highly regarded, acclaimed, top level advanced professor. So this is like the highest, deepest professor and very simple kindergarten teacher. So you would say, in terms of academia, of wisdom, of knowledge, of information, of IQ, whatever it is, right, you would say, perhaps, that the high-level professor is higher than the kindergarten teacher. And that's a greater accomplishment, right? It's a greater level. It's a greater place to be in. But think about it like this. The kindergarten teacher can teach astrophysics. Let's assume. Not, doesn't have to be, but let's assume that this kindergarten teacher cannot teach astrophysics. But let's also say that this astrophysics teacher cannot teach children either. Turns out, although this might be a more advanced, more academic teacher, but this teacher is also limited. This teacher might not be able to have a conversation with his or her spouse and remember what they said. And when they go shopping, they might forget the list because maybe they're the absent-minded professor type, right? So brilliant that, they may have difficulty understanding other things. But one could easily imagine a scenario where you have this top professor who cannot relate, wouldn't be able to get down on the floor and play a simple game of blocks with kids. Couldn't do that. If that's the case, then both have their limits. The kindergarten teacher can teach the postgrad students. And the advanced professor can teach the kindergartners. Each one is limited to their sphere, to their sandbox, to where they exist, to where they operate. And so, if we conceive of the following scenario, the following structure, that this world and this universe and this existence is limited, and God is infinite and unlimited, and therefore we can't relate to God, but God can't relate to finitude either. God is infinite and not finite if that's how we imagine it, then we are at that very same moment that we're trying to lift up God, we are cutting God short and we're limiting God by putting God up and not in. You see, the philosophers were only trying to do God a favor. They wanted God to be away from the mess that is our existence. And so they said, God cannot, this cannot be the totality of what God is and who God is. God has to be bigger and bigger and greater and more transcendent and beyond all of this. They were doing God a favor. But in doing God this so-called favor, they limited God. They limited God to the beyond and not the within. Kabbalah teaches text 15, the Avodat HaKodesh, and this is brought in many, many, many sources. Many Hasidic discourses and other, and many other Kabbalistic sources. Kabbalah teaches, text 15, just like God has the power of infinity, God has the power of finite. Yes.
Aren't we, though, in essence, his form of finite?
We're going to discuss what that means in a moment. But the first, the construct. And the construct that's important is, the important construct is, that to push God so far out and so far up, to make God so big that he's not here, that we can't understand or relate to him, is losing this true beyond limitations of God. Because now we're limiting God to being outside of us. And that's not truly beyond all limitations. That's further limiting God. Or that's another form of limiting God. So you can be limited inside or limited outside. Either way, you're not both places. The ultimate is no limitations. Not beyond, not within, both at the same time. So, what we're proposing here is that God is equally at home, equally present, equally real in a finite space as in an infinite space. That God possesses the ability to self-conceal and create limitation. In other words, God is not only beyond existence, but God is also within existence. And that's not in any rate, that's not in any way a second rate dimension of God or a lower dimension of God. That's an equally important dimension of God or reality of God. Because if God did not have that, God would be limited to the beyond and not to the within. So to understand this, let's do an exercise. In front of you, you have a pair of scissors. And you have a white paper. And underneath the white paper, there's a secret. There's a black paper. And so here's what I want you to do. I want you to take the black paper, and I'm going to do it with you. I'm going to take the black paper, and I want you to... before you do this. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. Just hold up the white paper for now. Okay, what do you see? What do you see? Okay, but what's on the paper? Nothing, honey. Okay, I like that answer. Okay, nothing, right? Nothing, just white, just emptiness, blank space, blank space, blank space. Take the black sheet. We do cutting. It's Kabbalah and cutting. Okay, take this, and I want you to cut a shape or a letter. Whatever you want. It has to be quick, though, because we don't have a lot of time to do this. Okay, I'm not going to show you what I did yet. You could do a few things. You could do one thing, shape, a letter, a picture, whatever you want, whatever you want. But remember, you're making a stencil here. That's the objective. You're making a stencil. Okay? Okay, okay. I'm going to give 20 more seconds, max. Folks, I know it's been a while with scissors and cutting. I know it's been a few years. Nassim, you have the edge here as the youngest member of our class. All right. Who's got something? You got something? Oh, no, you want to do the opposite. Yeah, so cut out your thing, but use the full black sheet as your... It's okay. I'm sorry, I was not clear, and that's on me. But either way, you're creating a stencil. You're creating a stencil with the black sheet. Okay? Yes? Yes, huh? Stencil. The opposite. You wanted to create the negative stencil. Yes, yes, good. I'm going to show you what I did. I did the most lopsided version of this that I've ever seen in my life. Okay? You ready for this? And I'm layering the black sheet over the white sheet. Having cut out some negative space, I'm going to layer it on top. You ready? You ready for the big reveal?
Yeah.
All right. This is my first big break as a you know, this is cutting edge art. Can we let that one, yeah. You ready? All right. Lopsided heart. You see that? You see that? Oh, so nice, right? It's yeah, I think so. Okay, so it's a heart, right? Where's the heart? What do you see as the heart? What do you see as the heart?
I get it.
The white. The white is forming the heart. Okay. So the heart is the white space, right? The heart is this. So you see a heart now, right? You see the heart now? Where's the heart?
It's the same place it was before.
So what happened?
It filtered through.
The frame.
See what happened? Look at yours. Look at yours. Look. Do your own example. See what's going on here? Okay. The white has, okay, maybe I can't say this perfectly, you know, but the white paper, again, it's not perfectly accurate, but theoretically has infinite possibilities. Theoretically. I know there's a certain number of pixels, whatever, it doesn't matter. Theoretically, an infinite number of possibilities or variations. Okay? And now, it's defined. And now it's defined. Right? So, it's a heart. And the heart is in the white space. If I cut out letters, if I had more time, if I had a stencil, I could cut out the word, the letters that form the word love. Or I could, it works the same way, yeah. It could be the black and the white, it doesn't matter. Yeah, that way it works, yeah. I could have cut out the word love or the word things or the word existence. And then I'll ask you a question. When the black covers the white, you see things, you see existence. When the white space, when the infinite white space is masked, finitude, definition, things, existence emerges. And when the mask is gone, the infinite returns. Kabbalah teaches that God creates a mask over his infinite reality. And that mask shapes and defines the finite reality. Who is the mask? Who is the black paper?
Nature.
It's also God. There's nothing outside of God. This is a self-masking experience. And God, in this experience of masking, self-masking, God sees the mask and the shape that emerges and everything as still part of him. But we see the definition that emerges from the masking experience. We see a new heart. We see letters. We see a word. We see definition and we see limitation. And from our vantage point, as we discussed in lesson one, it's true. But where did it come from? It's of the same essence as before. This is a heart, but it's not a heart. Does the heart exist? Yes and no. It exists, but it exists here like anything, any possibility exists. The heart exists as does any other possibility or impossibility. But once you mask it and you cut away, you cover everything else, and you only allow certain elements of the light to shine through, now you have definition. But what is at the core of that light shining through? It's the same infinite essence as before. This is how Kabbalah explains one of the most powerful concepts in Kabbalah, something that some of you are familiar with, but I don't know that you've ever seen it or heard of it in this way. The word that I'm referring to is called Tzimtzum. And I want to read, let's read this text, text number 20. Text number 20. Oh, and by the way, if you want to see this illustrated in your books, turn to page 107 and 108. You see that? 107 is a blank space. Turn the page to 108. And now things emerge. So that's the mask that they did in the book. But I felt like we should just do it in the class because it's So much better that way. Again, things, the letters that form the word things, they're there in the white space, but they're not there. But they're there, but they're not there. And even when they are there, it's still the same infinite white expanse that existed beforehand. Just now, it's the rest of it is masked. So this gets to the heart of Tzimtzum. Sarah, please read text number 20. This is one of the deep mystical texts. This comes from Eitz Chaim. Eitz Chaim was written, it's the wisdom of Rabbi Chaim, the wisdom of the Arizal, Rabbi Yitzchak Luria, written by, recorded by his student, Rabbi Chaim Vital. Thank you. We could have a whole class or series of classes just on these two paragraphs. And some of what you just read in these two paragraphs sounds like it's a little bit different than our masking experiment. But you should know, at the core of what we did with the two papers, with two sheets of paper, it's a very, very good way of understanding and conceptualizing the concept of Tzimtzum. It's not the totality of Tzimtzum. But it helps us really, I think, get a good understanding of what Tzimtzum is. Tzimtzum is contraction. What it actually means is blocking the light. And when you block the light, you allow finite light to shine through. So you mask most of the light, and you allow only a certain pattern of light to emerge, and that pattern of light that shines through the blockage, or the blockade, whatever you call it, right? So that light that shines through is now limited light. It's not infinite. It's not infinite possibilities. It's light that has now taken shape and taken specific, limited shape. So what does this mean for us? We said before that God is beyond existence, that God is so infinite, so beyond, that you can't even call God absolute existence because existence itself is a limitation. So God is beyond all limitation, even beyond existence. And then we said in the Avodah HaKodesh that if God is truly limitless, if God is truly limitless, then God must be beyond the limitation of being limitless. Because being limitless is also a limitation, because now you're relegating God only to the infinite and not the finite. And so Kabbalah says, on the deepest level, and this is explanation number 4, God is equally at home. God is equally present in the beyond as the within. God is the blank space and is the definition. God is the white sheet and the black sheet. God is the ultimate expanse or beyond expanse, and God is also that light that shines through. If you want to think about it just in the terms of the white sheet itself, the same white sheet that is infinite is the same white sheet that is finite. The letters that you see in white are on the same white sheet that is infinite. It's just when you have a mask, it appears finite, but it doesn't change its own essence. It's still that same white sheet. God remains infinite at the same time that He's finite. So what does this mean for us? First of all, we now have an understanding of some basic ideas in Torah. Number one, the concept that the Torah says that human beings are created in the image of God. If God does not have an image, if God is beyond all limitations, if God is beyond existence, then how does Genesis chapter 1, verse 26 tell us that the human being was created in the image of God? What image exactly are we created in? Since when does God have an image? The first hour and 10 minutes of the class, we destroyed the notion of God having an image. God has no image. He's the anti-image. And the human being is created in the image of God? What does that mean? So now we understand that God doesn't only have an anti-image, God also has an image. God is in the infinite and in the finite. And if you don't say that, you're limiting God to the infinite. You're closing God, you're blocking God out from the finite. And that's a further limitation. So God exists in the infinite and in the finite, which means, practically speaking, that when you ask the question, who is God? What is God? It is accurate to say that God is beyond existence, or God is absolute existence, or God is the creator of existence. All of those are true. And it's also true to say that God is the space, the makom, of existence itself. That is also true. God is beyond existence, and at the same time, God is the very substance of existence. And it's not a contradiction. God is outside and God is inside. God is the negative, God is the white paper, God is the black paper, God is the infinite expanse, and God is the letters that form from that masking tzimtzum. God is outside and God is inside. So here's the point. The implications of all of this are staggering. If we put the philosophy and the theology aside for a moment, what this means for you and I is that the world that we live in, everything that we touch, everything that we see, is at its core, what is it? It's pure, infinite, beyond existence, godliness. That's what this is. And that should give you the chills. Everything that exists is pure, infinite, beyond existence, godliness. It's the same God. Hashem Echad. God is one. There's only oneness. There's only oneness flowing through everything. Everything that exists is at its core pure divine energy. Not low divine energy, the same infinite beyond existence energy of God. And it appears to us as taking the shape of existence because of the mask, because of the tzimtzum. And that's a real mask for us, and it's a real limitation for us. But it's still God. God is the source. God is the mask. God is beyond. God is within. So the first implication is, number one, look at the world again. The world is a beautiful place. The world is a godly place. Take care of the world that you see. And I don't only mean clean up and environment and everything. The world is a holy place. It's a godly place. It's an infinite place. Treat it like it's holy, because it is. Number two, when faced with a moral dilemma and a question, should I do the right thing? Should I do the wrong thing? Does it really make a difference? When you think about a mitzvah, God really cares if I light the candles at 7:58 p.m. or 8:02 p.m. Does it really make a difference to God? Isn't God bigger than this? If you hold, like the philosophers, that God is too big to care, then maybe. But if you ascribe to what Kabbalah teaches, that God is the same God inside and outside, God is infinity, and God is the finite reality that exists, there's no divide. I mean, we had this in lesson one. God is the analog and the analogy. That was lesson one. All right. God is the point and the story, the metaphor. If this is the case, then yes, it matters on an absolute level. It really matters. And God really cares if it's 7:58 or it's 8:02. Or whatever it is, it doesn't matter. Whether we do the right thing or the wrong thing, what God really cares about me, I'm so small and God's so big. That's the impression you might have had from the first 70 minutes of this class. Oh, God is big, big, big. God's beyond existence. I guess we're off the hook. Sorry. Kabbalah comes along and says, "Kesheim shekocho bebilti bagvul, kach kocho bebalgvul." Just like God is infinite, God is also at the heart of that which is finite. Which means God is right here in this space, and what happens here matters. The third point is, yes, we can have a real relationship with God. How can you have a relationship with an abstraction? How can you have a relationship with something that doesn't even exist, perhaps? Not that God doesn't exist, but God is beyond existence, we said. That was like that third level of understanding God. God is beyond existence. How do you have a relationship with God who's beyond existence? How can you relate to that which is beyond? The good news is, God is not only beyond, God is also within. And He gave us Torah, and He gave us mitzvot, and the opportunity to pray, and the opportunity to connect. And God says, do these things, and we're connected. And we say, yeah, but you're bigger than this. And He says, who told you that? I told you if you do this, we're connected. You're telling me that I'm too big to be connected. You're limiting me to being big. What if I want to be small? What if I want to come down and tie your shoelaces? Can we connect on that level? As long as we affirm that, we can have a relationship with God. Not because we've made it, or we've decided, or we've chosen, but because God chose that. God took His infinite presence and made it a little bit smaller and a little bit more relatable. The Talmud says, in the place where you find God's greatness, you find His humility. God's greatness lies in the fact that He's not just big, but He also makes Himself accessible. And He makes Himself real to us. And everything that we see around us is divine. I want to conclude, I'll read this very quickly, with a prayer. The prayer is Adon Olam. And it's sung in many synagogues around the world, either before prayers or after prayers or before and after prayers. Famous song, Adon Olam Asher Malach. Famous, famous prayer. Reminds me of a story. I once walked into a friend's house and I saw this beautiful poem. I said, wow, that's so beautiful. Where did you get that from? Who wrote it? Oh, it's from the prayers, from the Siddur, the Shabbat prayers. I'm like, oh, I should probably know that. Right? So, that's from, So 23, we should know what we're saying when we sing this song. Listen carefully. And I want to ask you the question, can you identify the two themes of God? Really big and really personal. Master of the world who reigned before any creature was created. When by His will all things were made, then was His name called King. After all shall cease to be, the awesome one shall reign alone. He was, He is, and He shall be in glory. He is one, there is no second to compare Him with or to be joined. Without beginning, without end, might and dominion are His. He is my God, my living Redeemer, my rock and lot in times of distress. He is my banner and my refuge, my portion, my cup, on the day I call. In His hand I entrust my soul when I sleep and when I awake. With my soul and body, God is for me, I shall not fear. 10 stanzas here. The first 6 speak about God as being greater than, bigger than, mightier than, absolute, beyond absolute. And the last 4 speak about how God is relatable to me and what God means for me. May we all experience this gift of really understanding God. God not only in the abstract, God not only in the transcendental, God not only in the far removed from anything that we might know or anything that might constitute a limitation, and recognize that God is closer than we can ever imagine. Thank you very much for joining me today for lesson 3 of What Is.